Session number 10691, Reel 2.
Mrs. Natton, Reel 2.
He could have ignored it, but he didn't. He actually intervened and helped.
I don't know if you saw that series Tanker that they had on television, in which they attempted to depict the life of internees.
Was that accurate? I actually wrote to Lavinia Warner, who did the research with John Sandilands, and I did complain to Lavinia that it wasn't accurate, or as accurate as it should have been. But Lavinia pointed out quite rightly that to have shown the whole would have been far too much for many people to have taken in. And we also had to bear in mind that the people they had selected were from various camps. So it was under an umbrella title of Mtenko. But it was correct in many instances. All right, the fact that we weren't allowed any education, the fact that we were kept so suppressed and repressed, was perhaps not indicative of other camps. But I can only talk about the one that we were in, because that's the only one that I know of. We weren't allowed education, we weren't allowed access to paper. And it was... The whole area seemed to be charged just with trying to get through the hour and the day and then the next day and the days that came after. You had just to think of that moment and that time and try to make sure that you didn't do anything wrong. And for instance, we had to bow every day to the Japanese. Every time we saw a soldier, we had to bow. And I made friends with a young lady called Patrice Area. Mrs. Area had two daughters, Colette and Patrice. And Patrice was about my age. And we would bow to the Japanese guards or soldiers every time we saw them. But we'd swear in Dutch under our breath because they didn't understand Dutch. And we always had to say, Nippon Banzai, Nippon Banzai. We were very good at saying Nippon Banzai. There was one other incident. When the guards came back for this, having been beaten up by the Dutch ladies, everyone was on tenterhooks because we thought we were all going to be punished, because only one person had to do something silly or do something quite innocent or irritate the Japanese. And the whole camp, and it was a vast camp, it was about at least 1,000, had to take some form of punishment, which was in the main being deprived of food and, of course, standing out in the sun. And somebody, so it was the women facing these Japanese guards who weren't very happy at the time, because obviously they had to report to the officers as to why this particular event happened, why they had allowed themselves to be so demeaned in the eyes of their superiors, especially in the eyes of the women. We all waited around. And suddenly it occurred to me that I ended up my life, incidentally, as a singer. But I started to sing. I started to sing the Dutch Freedom Song, which is Lans van der Leven, Lans van der Leven. And other people took it up. And I think the soldiers couldn't do much with women who were singing, could they? It was pure instinct. Whenever I was scared, I sang.
Presumably... You must have just regarded the camp life as normal.
There was
nothing for you to compare it.
No, exactly. There was a degree of freedom in as much as, apart from our having to work, the adults had to work much harder than we did. The youngsters were running around quite wild, which is why they tried to get us into a school situation, but of course the Japanese wouldn't allow that. So we were made to work. We went out and we attended the Japanese gardens. My duty in particular, well, one of my duties, and some of the duties of the children in the camp, were that we had to collect buckets of water for the Japanese, which is one of the reasons my mother teases me that I have such long arms, because I was rather tiny and I had to carry these very large buckets. And even today, my arms are far, far longer than the rest of me, perhaps. And you had to fight your way through, because, again, with children do fight. And I found that when I got to the one tap in the centre of the camp, when it was my turn to get to the tap, there were some Dutch children who would then make sure that my buckets of water were emptied, purely because I think there was nothing else for anybody to do. It was one of those peculiar situations. And it meant that I had to then fill the buckets all over again and then empty them again. And you had a queue standing in the by. And, of course, you had the guards waiting for you to give them the buckets of water that their washing could be done. And you started panicking. So eventually you learned to fight. And it was quite amusing because I beat up two very large, little tiny, I beat up two large, two well-built Dutch boys. And their mother came and had a word with my mother. And she said, I have to complain about your daughter. And mother said, well, what trouble has she been into now? And she said, well, she beat up my two boys, and that's very wicked of her. So Willy Weiber, the Dutch journalist, laughed, and she said to the lady, also in Dutch, look, if I were you, I'd keep quiet the fact that this little girl beat up your two boys, because there'll be a lot of little girls trying to beat up those two boys. It's not something to be proud of. And so this lady went away. There was also in the camp a lady who was one of the wives of Laurens van der Post. And she and her, whether she was a wife or concubine, I don't quite know. But she said to me, she made friends with my mother. And she said to me, look, have you heard of Laurens? And Mum said, I'm sure he's alive somewhere. But she said, well, when you get out of the camp, would you tell him I'm here? And Mum, of course, promised, but we never really got in touch with Laurens after that. In fact, it took us a long time to realise that there were, in fact, people, that there were other prisoners in camps, perhaps not too far away, but we weren't allowed any communication or association at all. Mainly, it was trying to keep alive in some very, very peculiar circumstances. The bravery of some of the women was absolutely unbelievable, because it came to the point towards middle or the end of our stay in Bankinang that, because of the lack of food, children were eating anything that they could lay hands on, and they were eating the buds or the berries of this poisonous tapioca tree, which would blow them up and kill them. And some of the women went into a situation whereby they were almost shocked, and they wouldn't or couldn't do anything. I think it's not that they wouldn't do anything, they couldn't do anything, but they couldn't comprehend the situation. Their minds had been completely and totally blown. But, again, Dr. Lyons was wonderful, because she got hold of the British contingent and she said, look, we've got us children together. And she said, you do not eat these. You will be punished by me if you eat these. You do not eat them because they're bad for you and you will die. But it got to a stage also where perhaps dementia was creeping in, and some of the Dutch ladies were just throwing the children out of the windows, out of the shelters weren't very large, but they were throwing them out because, they just couldn't cope with the situation as it was. So it took a particular kind of person to survive that ordeal. But there again, it's easy to make judgments. They had perhaps more than one child. It's easy when you have only one child to look after. When you have more than one, it gets more than a problem. So it's not an area whereby you make any rash judgments, because nobody knows what you're going to do in a situation if you were put there. Dr. Lyons, I cannot speak too highly of. She was absolutely wonderful. She removed teeth. She performed operations. There was one in particular where a lady had to have an operation done. And the whole of the camp, all the women, she had arranged it whereby, because it was so dusty, in the middle of the camp there was this little hut. She had sacks, gunny sacks, just put around it for cover. And she had women and children in a sort of pail situation, whereby we were all carrying pail. Water would be taken to keep the dust down, so she could perform this operation in as safe a situation as she could. So she organised everyone, and everyone was involved. So there was this pail which started out, say, from point A, and was taken right away down the line. Children, adults of all denominations, all nationalities involved, because there was a person there who needed help, and she organised that. So the water situation kept flowing to help keep the dust down. She removed teeth, all sorts of things, but we didn't receive any Red Cross parcels, didn't know if anyone was alive. All you were concerned with was getting through the day. Yes, the children did run wild, and I started smoking, and my mother said to me, you shouldn't do that. But towards the end, the women were so hungry because they were actually giving us their food. The mothers giving the children their food. And you had nothing else to sell. So my mother, even when I was ill, went to sell her wedding ring. And my mother was most reluctant to part with this last little bit of her marriage. But Billy Wilder again said, look, Min, I'm sorry, you've got a decision to make. It's either the ring or your daughter. So Mum reluctantly went and sold it to someone. And there was a lady there who was not particularly nice. But it was a sad story because she was hoarding up. She'd come into the camp with money. And she was buying things off people right, left and centre. But she didn't live to enjoy it because she died. Again, no one knows why one does certain things in situation or certain situations, and you learn not to judge. When the boys came to a certain age, they were taken away into the men's camp, so that meant that there had to be a men's camp there. But in the main, you just kept very busy. I was kept busy near Mum, tending the Japanese gardens or whatever, and you virtually ran very well, but you learned to look after yourself. I can also remember, and this, for some reason, this is very vivid, it's running across the camp yard in the just before sunset and looking at this whole camp situation and wondering, there was so much space, there weren't any people about. And it was just that moment that occurs when you're in absolute isolation and you wonder, what am I doing here? What's happening? Because you grew up very, very quickly. You learn to fight your battles very quickly. You learn to steal. You learn to lie. But you had to. You had to.
Were you able to converse with any of the Japanese?
Yes, I was able to converse with a number of them, but it was sort of pigeon Malay, because I learned to speak Malay as well. I'm still very fluent with Malay, oddly enough. And
what would they say to you?
Just, are you good? And you'd say yes. And sometimes they'd say, I got a child like you. And they would show you photographs, and they say, and sometimes they would confide to you, know, we worry, your mother worry about you, we worry, our children, our wife, we know, see. It was, so you did come to see another side of it. A number of them seemed unhappy about being there and unhappy in having to do what they did. But there was one instance that was quite painful, again, not involving children, I might add. But you had some of the Koreans who liked to show how big and how mighty and how wonderful they were. And there were some animals in the camp. And just to demonstrate how mighty this particular gentleman was, he just took his broadsword and he cut the dog's head. That was an isolated incident, I might add. There was also another funny incident, fun in inverted commas, because a lady came in with 9 cats. Her name was Sadie Gifning. German lady came with 9 cats, and she couldn't wonder why her cats started disappearing. Well, her cats started disappearing because people were eating them. You didn't question what you ate, you just ate it very gratefully. But she couldn't understand why her cats were disappearing. I think Sadie was perhaps did not have all her faculties, or was not very streetwise, perhaps. And she didn't really cotton on to the fact that people were stealing and were killing the cats in order to survive. But the Japanese in themselves, the guards, they had their duty to do, and there was this awful tenko. If they had a good day, then there was relatively peaceful, inasmuch as you just got on with your daily duties and tried to stay out of trouble and tried to stay from attracting too much attention. But if the war wasn't going very well, or something upset them, then of course it was this tenko standing out. If it was Hirohito's birthday, it was great celebrations. And there's one other thing: people said that Hirohito didn't come up, but he did. He came to our camp, because I remember that there was great excitement on the part of the Japanese. Everything had to be clean and sparkling, and we were attired in our best, which in my case was purely a pair of knickers, and because you just ran wild barefoot. And I can remember this gentleman coming and standing under this pole with a Japanese flag. I didn't know at the time who he was, but he was on horseback, and he had this very, very long sword, and everyone was virtually kowtowing. It was almost like they were hailing a god. And we had to, a small contingent of us had to stand out. And he took down, I was taken for some unknown reason. Perhaps because I had fair hair, I don't quite know the reasons. But I was taken to him, and he looked at me and he said, little girl, are you happy? And I said, no. And he said, but you should be happy. You are well looked after. And I said, no. And he said, little girl, what is your name? I gave him my name. And he said, where is your father? I said, you should know, probably one of your prison but eventually, somebody later said I was very... He said, oh, you are happy, you are well-fed. He could see we weren't happy, he could see we weren't well-fed, because Mum was to say everybody was thin, and you just wanted to eat him and his horse. But we were told later that that was Emperor Hirohito making an unexpected and very rare visit, apparently by submarine and to the camp. And one person, one of the Japanese officers, said to me, "You are a very honoured child." And I said, "Why?" He said, "You're talking to the God himself. You're talking to the God." And I said, "Do you mean Jesus?" He said, "No." I said, because I didn't know Jesus looked like that. He said, "No, Imperial Majesty Hirohito."
What are your feelings about the Japanese today? Has it left you with any bitterness towards them?
No, no, because it was a war situation. None at all. You can't blame the present, the young people, for what went on in the past, because there were things done on both sides. It was a war situation. I don't feel any bitterness towards them, no. I just feel sorry that it had to happen to us, that we were caught up in the situation. Mum was so terribly thin when she came out of the camp. I think she was about 4 stone, if that. But then everybody was thin. Everybody suffered very badly from malnutrition. And I think the whole idea behind the Japanese system was that women were obviously of a lesser species. And it was their way of perhaps getting back at men. We have your women here. But no, no hate at all. Because who's to say what you would have done had the situation been reversed? And, as I say, they didn't actually perform any acts of unkindness to us children personally. I mean, except for 2 occasions which horrified me, apart from the dog being hurt, killed, was one lady was accused of black marketeering. And there was an awful lot of problems about it. Whether she was guilty or innocent, we didn't know. Nobody knew. Nobody knew why they did certain things or why they caught on to certain people. It could have been perhaps because they were just feeling not... It hadn't been a pleasant day. But this lady was taken away in question, and she said she didn't know anything. We heard all this via the grapevine, because you had a lady who had been in our camp, who had gone to work for the Japanese, and she very kindly fed us back a lot of information, as much as she possibly could, in the circumstances. But I can remember her being dragged away screaming to one of the Japanese huts, and we heard much later that she did come out alive, but they'd actually let the drunken Japanese soldiers in, and they probably raped her. But she ended her life in a mental asylum. After the war, she was taken away. Billy Wybrow was absolutely wonderful, this American, because at times when perhaps my mother was wilting, Billy was stalwart, and she said, I haven't got any children, but you have. Therefore, you've got to fight. You've got a stake in the future. There was a lady, Lady Margaret Walker. She's in Scotland. She married her, I think she married a cousin. And she was very hungry one day, and she would have given a great deal to have just something to eat. And my food was there when I was in hospital. And Mum said to her, look, in fact, I was out of hospital, but I wasn't eating properly. And my mother said to Lady Margaret Walker, Margaret, she called her, look, here's, eat her food. And Margaret said, I can't. But Mum said, but look, it's, she won't eat it. I can't get her to eat. It's only going to waste. Eat it. And Margaret did say to Mum, well, look, that's, you don't know how hungry I was. I was starving hungry. And Mum said, well, somebody else did that for me in the ship. So it was a question of, always repaying a karmic debt. There was a great deal of kindness amongst the people themselves. They were all trying to get on with their lives and all trying to save themselves. There was very little of selling up or ratting on people. It didn't happen because you knew that you needed each other. Therefore, you stayed with each other. And that incident with the lady being taken screaming away wasn't very nice. There was another incident whereby the Japanese thought for some unknown reason, again, that Mum had some information. I think they were just panicking around as the war drew on, and they tried to find out what was happening, or they were uncertain of what was happening. They would be rather volatile. No one knew exactly what orders they were getting from head office or from Japanese command or whatever. But they thought Mum had some information. Perhaps she was in the right place at the wrong time or the wrong place at the right time, who knows. But I was standing by her, standing with her. And they said, you know something. Mum turned around horrified and, you know, what is happening? What do you want? They'd, you tell us, you tell us. It was almost a desperate situation on their part. And they actually built a fire and they were going to burn me. And Mum was by this time, I can remember her being over there, the flames coming to me, and Mum saying, shouting out, they were trying to almost bully her into saying things that she couldn't possibly say because she didn't know anything about her. The women behind Mum were so horrified at what they were seeing. It was only a group of them, and they were trying to get more people to come and witness this, but it was kept rather quiet. And Mum called out to me, look, I've told them, I cannot tell them anything, darling, you do understand. I can't tell them anything, I don't know, and I can't help you, because they were restraining her. And I called out to her, I understand, don't worry, I'll be with Jesus soon. Again, timing, some officer just came by and stopped it. It was just weird. They seemed at times so kind, times so volatile. I think it was just the war situation, the fact that they didn't know where they were, they didn't know what they were going to do. We were made to go and dig holes. And then my mother turned around and said, why are you making us dig trenches? And they said, because we're going to shoot you all. And of course, that scared the living hell out of us children. And we started crying and running away. But in the main, you had to accept the situation as it was, because there wasn't much else you could do.
Was that towards the end of the war?
It was towards the end of the war. And perhaps things were getting a little bit desperate. And as I said, they were perhaps losing the war. But they had their nice moments. This is why it was so insane. Towards the end of the war, there were about four or five of us children, and I was known as the camp reporter because I knew I was getting into anything and everything, and because there wasn't any education, there wasn't anything for us to occupy ourselves with apart from work. And therefore I would poke my nose into places that I shouldn't, and I still do that to this day. And one of the Japanese told us, guards him, come here, little girl. And so there was a couple of other children near us, and they said, war is going to end soon. You all go back home. And so I ran and told everybody, and I told Dr. Lyons and I told Mummy, and of course there was a little meeting there because I said, no, he says, you know, he says we're going to be released soon. And then again, another surprising thing, towards the end of the war, some of the Japanese soldiers took us into a hut, some of us children into a hut. That must have been Patrice. Can't remember the names of all the others, but about, say, six or seven of us. And they had this table with fruit. And believe it or not, ice cream. What looked like ice cream. We were absolutely amazed, and they were very kind. And we ate ourselves silly, and we didn't quite know what we were eating. But this was, again, the kindness towards the end. And when it was actually announced, of course, I went racing back to say, yes, it must be true, because, you know, they've given us food, and we'd have given anything for food. And towards the last few weeks of the war, of the end of the war, the traders were allowed to come in and trade with us. Now, we had to be rather careful. We didn't have anything to sell. So this is a rather funny story. Billy Wybro had stored away a dress, because she was determined that when the war finished, when we had survived, she was going to meet John Wybro, her fiancé, in really dressed very well, and she had hidden this dress in the bowels of the earth. Well, I saw all this food coming in. I was so damn terribly hungry. And I stole Billy Wybro's dress, and I went and bartered it, and I came back with a chicken under one, and a coconut under another. And Billy couldn't find her dress, and there was me standing with the chicken under one and the coconut under another. And she said, you've done it, you've taken that. But of course, it was only a momentary thing. But Billy said, don't let that child come near me because I'll kill her. But it wasn't said in spite. It was said in pure frustration, relief, anger, call it whatever you will. But later on, Billy called me to her and she said, I said, why were you staying with me, Auntie Billy? She said, she explained, I was keeping this to wear for John, and I'm going to see John in rags and tatters because that's all they had on. But she said, there's an even more important lesson. You could have made a better bargain. That dress deserved more than just a chicken and a coconut. Which was quite funny. And even now, it strikes me as being rather funny. And whenever Mum talks about my son, her grandson, smoking, towards the end, the women were so hungry that even the priests or the religious people, because the Dutch doctor was advocating that we kill and eat rats. And Dr. Lyne said, well, I'm not saying that you shouldn't eat it. I'm saying think before you eat, because you don't know really what disease the rats are carrying. So the British contingent, in the main, listened to Dr. Lyne's, because she was marvellous. She was the leader. She was one who had knowledge. And only tiny, the Japanese could hit her, and she'd still fight them back. Hit me, I don't care. And they'd stop her right, left and centre. And tiny woman. She was absolutely marvellous. She wasn't beautiful. She was there, and she was tough. And she said, I don't care what you do, these people need to be looked after, they need medicine. We didn't get any, but it was the fact that she was there, and they were wary of her, and in a funny sort of way respected her for the way that she stood up to them. It was amazing. There's also a funny story, because we had a Granny Jones with us, and we were all in very peculiar housing. It wasn't housing as such, because there was no privacy. The only privacy you had was perhaps a gunny sack or a rucksack between you and the family of persons next door. And a drunken Japanese soldier came into Granny's quarters and didn't know where he was. And Granny sort of went to the back of the quarters and started watching him. When, of course, he started to take down his trousers, that's when Granny went absolutely berserk and shouted, and everybody came. But it was purely a person who was drunk, not knowing where he was going. But we found Granny late, and she hid herself in the Japanese hen houses, chicken coops.
Do you remember liberators coming into the camp?
Yes, I do. I can remember, first of all, our being told that we were free, and this marvellous feeling, but also crying. People started to cry. One Dutch lady went up to the Japanese commanding officer, who was bringing down the rising sun and putting up the flag. And she went and hugged him. But people also started crying. As a child, I wondered, why are they crying? We're free. But it was explained to me later that it had been so long that no one had thought that this was going to be such a long war. No one knew what was lying in wait for them. It was quite an emotional time for the women, many of whom had stopped their periods as well. They didn't quite know what they were going back to. So there was a lot of crying, a lot of apprehension. But yes, the liberation was wonderful, because you had suddenly this feeling of euphoria. Well, on the part of the children, it certainly was, because there was food coming, and that was our main concern. And people suddenly started believing that they were going to... that it was freedom, that the war was finished, we were going to go home. And that was really marvellous. You found traders coming in. There was a freedom, a laxity that you hadn't had before. And yes, Billy Wyber is a Dutch journalist, because suddenly the Americans are very much in command, didn't have time to say goodbye to us all. But she was a nice, great big limousine came.